The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. This is a show where we deal with the Russian Orthodox faith from many points of view, philosophical, historical, ethnic, in terms of the ancient world, the Middle Ages, the modern world. We deal with this singular faith and tradition with its center in both the Russian and Ukrainian land, and we deal with it as this global movement, as this global way of thinking. And today, what we're going to do is deal with another church father, somebody who is of immense significance, partially because of his philosophical depth, partially because he died in 202 A.D., so is pre-Nicene and is very significant because he was a student of St. Polycarp, a direct student of St. John, the Apostle John, the evangelist. Now, some time ago, I did a broadcast, something that needed to be said, about the constant presence of this very dangerous, arrogant, presumptuous, pretentious kind of amateurism in these fields. And this is a classic example, something that's really caused me a lot of problems, where people who actually believe that if they read the Bible, which, of course, they only very rarely do, they read pieces of it, that they somehow know Christianity. First of all, there is no such thing as mere Christianity. The word hides more than it reveals. There are very specific points of view around Jesus Christ, the Orthodox, the Catholic, the general Protestant, Monophysite, Nestorian, etc., really, the Catholic, Orthodox, and general Protestant point of view are the only real three major ones. But to use a word like Christianity without defining it is this sloppy thinking and a sign of amateurism. But it's also a sign of dishonesty, because lumping all followers of Christ together and giving them one label permits you to be very intellectually lazy, because you could say whatever you want, and I'm sure you could find some idiot who will back you on it, some pastor or something like that. So it's really a sign of not only amateurism, but of intellectual dishonesty and laziness. When dealing with the average Protestant, with a few exceptions out there, I realize that talking to them is really a waste of time. It's because, you know, they claim that Christianity is the Bible and Bible is Christianity. I then say to them, where did the Bible come from? And they either don't know or they start calling me names. And the fact is that the Bible is a collection of 74 books of very, very different types. Everything from poetry to expository prose to biography, every kind of genre of the ancient world is to be found there. And it was put together over a long period of time in both local and ecumenical synods, and put together by men who at the time were the masters of both the Greek and the Latin language. St. Athanasius is indispensable. The Alexandrian catechetical school, which he was a part of, is indispensable. And St. Irenaeus of Lyon, who is the man we're going to be dealing with today, is also indispensable. The idea that the apostles laid out a tradition, the apostles laid out a way of thinking that then developed into the basic concept of the early Greek and Latin Orthodox vision. The Church Fathers, many of whom were students or students of students of the Apostles, can't be ignored, and to ignore them is laughable. It's absurd. Claiming that the Bible is Christianity is somewhat akin to saying that I know America and I know American politics because I've read the Constitution. And you don't bother to read any of the big Supreme Court decisions or the Founding Fathers or the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists and all the big issues that have come up since the ratification of the Constitution. Claiming that the Constitution is America is absurd. Claiming that the Bible is Christianity is even worse. And the fact is that both then and now, the average person simply can't read the Bible. You can't read the Psalms, you can't read wisdom, you can't read these things without understanding their context, without understanding the nature of the vocabulary, without understanding the entire philosophical and historical sense that informs all of these words. And especially 2,000, 3,000 years after these things have been accomplished or written down, to think that we can just magically put ourselves into that context is puerility. It's intellectually dishonest, it is lazy, and is very typical of that amateur mentality who wants a shortcut to knowledge. They don't want to do the years of painstaking work that it requires to become knowledgeable in a subject. They would much rather memorize a few slogans, and at a cocktail party, it'll make them sound smart. So today, we're going to deal with St. Irenaeus, who is one of the earliest of the Church Fathers, active in the middle and end of the second century, and a man who was absolutely essential in building up the philosophical and historical mind of the ancient Orthodox Church. And in his case, in the West, he's based in Lyon in France, and is somebody who's written a lot, and again, is you really can't read or understand the Christian faith and its ancient and Orthodox manifestation without having some familiarity with these men who laid out what that faith is. The books of the Bible that were approved by major figures like Irenaeus or Athanasius, Clement, and then of course the popes of Rome, as well as the popes of Alexandria and elsewhere, who laid out the tradition coming from the apostles, and from not only from the writings of the apostles, but also from the apostolic canons, which is this system of canon law, which was written down in the apostolic period and became really the foundation for the Orthodox mentality. The apostolic canons were written at the time of the apostles, no doubt had been added to as the centuries went on for new situations and new developments, but they are themselves the sort of a blueprint for the tradition as it developed around the same time that the scriptures were written down in the first place, the New Testament anyway. The big issue is that the books of the Bible were debated by some of the masters of the Greek language of their day, and they were chosen only because the doctrine manifested there was in accord with the tradition that they themselves had received from the apostles, from the apostolic canons, from the liturgy, from the way of life of the Christians that could be traced to the time of Christ himself. Deviations from that, whether it be the Gnostics or the Paulicians or these other people who imported certain magical Judaic ideas from Babylonia and from the Talmud, which was just in the process of being written down at the time, they were known as heretics because they were importing these kind of corrupt ideas into the basic mainstream of the tradition. And this tradition is the grounds for accepting or rejecting a book of the Bible. Now, St. Irenaeus wrote on church history quite a bit. Now, he's active in the middle of the end of the second century. So there's not much history to write on at the time. But St. Irenaeus, a student of St. Polycarp, Polycarp himself, a student of St. John the Evangelist, these people have tremendous authority. And why they're ignored by Protestants and even many Roman Catholics is really a mystery. First of all, Irenaeus does confirm through documents, I'm sure, which existed at the time, probably don't exist anymore, confirm the apostolic foundation of the major churches. It would be in Rome, Middle East, North Africa. He learned the doctrine of St. John directly from St. Polycarp, who was a student of St. John. He says that the great Clement was a companion of St. Paul, Clement of Rome. And, you know, certain areas, certain cities are superior one to another, not necessarily because they have some jurisdictional control, but because of their ancient lineage. And the lineage of the apostolic foundation is the source of their authority. The apostolic succession for him is absolutely central. Without apostolic succession, you have nothing but an arbitrary approach to interpreting the sacred writings. And when he says sacred writings, he's not just talking about these things which had yet become the Bible. There were plenty of gospels and the prophetic writings and the Psalms floating around, and they were treated as gospel. They had not yet been stamped with the approval of the entire church via its synods. But we're talking about the middle of the second century, and he is quoting, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as if these have been authoritative texts for a long time. Kind of blows away this all this kind of absurdity that the apostles didn't write this stuff and it was written later on. Ignatius of Antioch, who himself was a student of Peter, several other apostles in Greek-speaking Syria. Also, he dies in 99 A.D., and he's quoting Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John like it's the most ordinary thing in the world. So, again, without reading these guys and understanding what they're saying, you know, people who are anti-Christian, half, you know, 99% of the time, they don't know anything. They don't know the faith. They read something in a Bible. They've heard that there's, you know, a contradiction here, a problem there. They don't understand. And I get angry because I said, you know, the church fathers wrote on all of these topics, all of these problems that you have were dealt with 1,500 years ago, if not earlier. And because you're too lazy to look at them and to pay attention to them, you're just repeating the same things that these guys have long since dealt with. The debates with pagans like Celsus, Jews like Philo of Alexandria, these debates, people like Justin Martyr, very early church father, are everywhere. All of these problems, all of these debates are still going on, but they're being carried on by people who have never read the actual original sources of all of these things. And people, you know, they say stupid things like, how come God allows evil in the world? And, you know, like they're saying something profound. And in fact, every major church writer in the first century dealt with these things at length. And the fact that you're too lazy to read them doesn't mean that you're going to visit that on me or anybody else. And, you know, people are betting their souls on doctrine, on a falsity, on, you know, atheism and secularism, based on what is a almost non-existent knowledge of the ancient writings of the first and second centuries of several dozen masters of both the Greek and the Latin language, although mostly the Greek language. Irenaeus is writing in France, but he is writing overwhelmingly in Greek. It should be noted that he holds that Jerusalem is the mother church. Jerusalem is the mother of all the churches. The apostolic succession, the apostles and the canons that they laid down, and of course, the apostolic canons to me are equal to Scripture in terms of their authority. But that apostolic succession is that guarantee of truth, the guarantee that the tradition has remained singular and solid, and that a heretic is always known because he shows up with very strange doctrine. And what was going on at the time is that these Jews were pretending to convert, bringing in concepts that we would call today something from the Kabbalah or something from the Talmud, some amalgam of those occult doctrines coming from Babylon and Assyria, and they were converting and sounding very intelligent for the sake of harming and doing damage to the faith. The point of the power of the bishop, especially in the ancient world, was to maintain that singular connection to the apostolic canons, to the books of the New Testament, to many of the books that were never accepted but still worthwhile, and this tradition as a whole, and you know, the canons and the writings of these men and the writings of the New Testament, they are not the fullness of the tradition. The grace, the presence of God on earth, that is the fullness of the tradition, and it can be abbreviated by canon and the short works of the New Testament. So Irenaeus is making it clear that the bishop is an apostolic foundation. He knows this for a fact, and that the point of the bishop was to serve as an apologist, to draw the line as to where true doctrine was and where false doctrine was. True doctrine came from and was part of and could be understood only via the tradition that the apostles laid down, whether it be through their writings or through their canons or through their oral teaching, that by the time of Irenaeus really wasn't all that old. And this became the foundation. So when you want to know what the truth is, you go to these men, students of the apostles and their successors, and see what they had to say about precisely these same questions. How do you know what the truth is when there are dozens and dozens of churches out there all claiming some knowledge? These men laid it out in great detail. But the real error is to pretend that you're going to sit down and read the Psalms and know what you're looking at. You're looking at it with modern eyes. You're looking at it from a bias and how we read things and how we understand words and concepts in the 20th, 21st century, forgetting, of course, that these men were writing in a very, very, very different time. Now, I don't want to stress here that Irenaeus and the church fathers that helped put the Bible together, that these men didn't believe that scriptures were the dominant thing. They did. But they were the dominant thing only because they were the most cohesive and the most comprehensive set of ideas and set of doctrines that became the standard of appeal. But these things became the standard because they fit in with this broader tradition. The scriptures are little more than the writings of men who experienced God's presence. Without that experience, scriptures, the tradition, the sacraments, the liturgy, they don't mean anything. But in terms of doctrinal appeal, scripture is the primary. But only because it is the most cohesive and comprehensive expression of the tradition. I also want to stress that if you are going to read the Bible with this understanding that you're going to find a closed system, that's also, you're not going to find it. The Bible is never meant to be a closed system. Christianity itself, in its ancient Orthodox and largely Greek background, itself is never meant to be a closed system. The presence of God on earth is infinite. It is of infinite power. The human mind can grasp a few small things, those things necessary for our knowledge, for our salvation, for a rational life, and that's probably it. God allows us to know what we need to know. Tradition is based on the apostles and on the apostolic sees that were founded throughout Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa. The tradition, according to St. Irenaeus, can be seen in the writings of Clement, Pope of Rome, who was a student of St. Peter, and Polycarp, who was a student of St. John. So if you want the mentality of the apostles, you just don't read the very short things that they put together and that have been collected into the Bible. They also wrote other things and taught men to promote certain ideas over others, and that itself became the standard for figuring out what scriptures should be in and what should be out. The point of the bishops is to transmit this. Bishops are not dictators. They do not run the church. They are merely people who set a hedge around doctrine. This is in, this is out. A line has to be drawn, especially in times of great instability. The universal church is not the Pope of Rome. It is not even the Bishop of Jerusalem. It is the entire collection, the college of bishops assembled in synod, what we would call the ecumenical synods of the church. That is the universal church in the mode of activity. Okay, we're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back in a minute.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We're dealing with the great St. Irenaeus of Lyon, writing in Greek, dying in 202 AD, one of the earlier of the Church Fathers, who laid out doctrine identical with that which was adopted by the Universal Church at Nicaea many, many, many generations prior to it actually being laid down in legal form in the Nicene Synod. I do want to stress here that the first ecumenical synod of Nicaea didn't invent doctrine. It didn't create doctrine. It simply took the writings of the great scholars who helped put the scriptures together and ratified that which is in accordance with the universal church, and that which is not. The ultimate appeal is the tradition received from the apostles and their students. Without them, you can't have the church. You can't appeal to scripture, because scripture itself, which books were in and which books were out, that itself was controversial. There has got to be this final court of appeal, and that final court of appeal was tradition, or the doctrines of the apostles as it had been passed down by the bishops of the major cities and regions which themselves had been founded by the apostles. St. Irenaeus, writing in the middle of the second century, lays down in detail which apostles founded which cities. There are many of the great church historians in Constantinople and elsewhere in Rome who were talking about the different apostles founding sees and monasteries and bishoprics throughout Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa, largely the Greek-speaking world, but also the Syriac-speaking world in the Middle East and the Latin-speaking world as well. Without that foundation, without the apostolic foundation, you don't have a church. You have an arbitrary set of books floating around that people are reading without the proper background, philosophical understanding, historical understanding, and of course, as always, they've come up with these arbitrary interpretations that more often than not derive from their self-interest rather than from the truth of the matter. And it should be noted that almost all the apostles, with the exception of John, were murdered. They were murdered both by pagans and Jews, although I think the pagans were egged on by Jews, because these men were causing riots wherever they went, because the rabbis were declaring war on them as many of the younger members of the synagogue were coming over and abandoning the long since corrupted law. And the scribes and Pharisees that controlled it and used the law to destroy dissent, to destroy any fissures in their ranks. So these apostles were murdered and their students were murdered. In fact, it says right in the Acts of, or the martyrdom of St. Polycarp, it was the Jews that were the ones who demanded his execution, and they went and they got the wood and everything else, and they burned him. The writer goes out of his way to say that it was the Jews who did this. So, That's the general historical doctrine that St. Irenaeus lays out. And the ultimate court of appeal, which is the apostolic tradition deriving from those regions whose bishops are in the immediate apostolic line. The whole point of the succession is that an apostle founds a see, a bishopric in a certain city. The apostle stays there with a small group of people and teaches them the doctrine, both written and not written, that Christ taught them. Those people then elect a bishop from among their own ranks who has a job of teaching that doctrine. They then elect a successor and a successor and a successor. And these men that I'm citing from, whether it be Irenaeus or Clement or Athanasius, these people are exactly who I'm talking about. These people are bishops who derive from that direct succession. It was preached in public. It was written down in these writings that I'm citing from now. There was no getting around it. You couldn't violate it without losing your people. The ultimate court of appeal is historical. This is about doctrine. The one thing that paganism is not about is doctrine. Paganism is just secularism. There's no difference. The pagan worships matter. Matter is God because, according to them, matter is eternal, and matter is creative of all things, including consciousness, free will, and the spirit. That is an inversion, of course, of the truth of the matter. And it is an inversion of Plato, who was certainly no pagan, who wasn't much of anything. And many of these men, Irenaeus included, did view Plato, Socrates, and that whole idealistic Greek tradition as, in and of itself, prophetic. Prophets of the Old Testament paved the way for Christ in the New, led by John the Baptist, of course. But amongst the Greeks, it was a great philosopher, especially Plato, who prepared the Greek mind for the gospel. I became a Christian only because I was a Platonist first. Justin Martyr says the exact same thing. Now, the Platonic vision is found in nearly all Greek church fathers, that Christ solved the problems that Plato had set out. One of the most severe problems, and something that Aristotle will beat Plato up for, is how the forms, eternal truths, which are not material, they can be instantiated in men, but they're not material, how does one reach them? And how do you know when you see one? When you experience one, really is a better term. And for Plato, it was a tiny handful of eccentric ascetics who were capable of seeing even glimpses of the forms. The material world was just too powerful, and it anchored them in such a way that they really could not experience the forms except in the most general of terms. And as Justin Martyr and as Irenaeus and as Augustine and so many others said, Christ solved the problem because the logos, the wisdom, the rationality of natural law, the law that makes nature this regular thing that we could study, that was not sufficient. Logos had to become a person and get right in their face as an individual. And that's exactly what the incarnation was. The incarnation brought the forms of Plato into direct, immediate contact with the common person. And Christ says it's not the scholars, it's not the academics, the scribes of his day, that are going to teach the truth. It's the simple. It's the simple person. It's the non-arrogant person. It's the humble man. This is the person that can approach wisdom with a capital W. God the Father made all things, but he made all things according to his word. Word is logos. It is the essence. It is the instantiation of the form of the good in nature. It makes nature a regular, law-bound thing. The Son, Jesus Christ, is logos taking human form, because only in taking human form would people listen to him. Logos, the reason in nature was an abstraction. The average person, even the average intellectual, couldn't grasp what that meant. An essence, a Platonic form. These, for the average person, even for the average philosopher, were abstractions. They were unreal. We are human beings in flesh. We can't consider that which is completely immaterial. The Son is Logos. It is the work of the Father made visible. He says that Christ was born under the reign of Augustus because it was the largest extent of the Roman Empire. And the system of roads was so well done that communication and building the church at that time in the ancient world was the ultimate way that the church would spread. It's not an accident that the height of the empire was the time where Christ came. It is the unity of our human nature with the form of the good, the presence of God, that eliminates sin and that gives us the opportunity to experience Plato's forms in real, day-to-day, actual life. Not just this handful of eccentrics that Plato had posited, the only people who could even never even understand the forms. They could take a glimpse of the immaterial truths. The Holy Spirit is the wisdom, is the sanctifying power of God. The Trinity is something for people like Irenaeus or John of Damascus. It was never hard for them to explain. You think of the human mind. Think of the human mind as the Father. You think of the expression of that mind, like I'm talking to you right now, and the words that I'm using, and the concepts that I'm using. That's the Son. It's all really the same thing in essence, but two very different things. My mind and that which the mind creates are one and the same, but they are also very different. The Spirit is the force, the impact that words have on you, good, bad, or indifferent, that you understand them, that you could put them into action. All three of these derive from my mind. All three of these are essentially mind seen from different points of view. That's St. John of Damascus's defense of the Trinity. There's lots of them. I think St. Augustine in De Trinitate says the same thing. Although in using different words, it's pretty much the same concept. Think of the Son as the Father in action. The Father is perfect. The Father is infinite. You know, if you're perfect and infinite, you don't move. You don't change anything, but that doesn't mean you're totally inactive. That activity manifests itself also as God in the Son. God's activity must be God by definition. The thought and action of God must itself be divine. God the Father automatically generates the Son just by his very nature. But the Spirit is how that action affects us. The Holy Spirit is one of these things that specializes only in mankind. It serves mankind, continually convert people and to forgive sins. It, in a sense, applies the activity of God the Father, i.e. Logos, to humanity. And people like Irenaeus, Augustine, John of Damascus, these people stress the idea that if God the Father exists, then God the Son must exist. Because God the Father must be active. He must do something. And if he does something, that must then be Logos, or his wisdom, or his presence. One of these days, I'm going to do something on St. John of Damascus. Here's somebody that wrote a mountain of material. He was a Greek speaker, but he was, for a time, the official secretary of the Islamic Caliphate in Syria. He was a Greek speaker, and he knew the Greek Orthodox population very, very well, and so he was very useful to them. And he wrote on Islam. Why is no one reading this guy? He was the official personal secretary to the caliph in Damascus, in Syria, for a while. That was one of his jobs, and he wrote a book on Islam. Who was closer to Islam than he was? And no one reads him. This is insane. You can't understand this stuff in this time and the mentality in the church and everything else unless you read these men. These were extraordinary individuals. They were masters of the Greek language. Anyway, that's how Irenaeus and really most of the church fathers, including St. John, will understand the Trinity. One of the things that St. John of Damascus, in his capacity as secretary to the caliphate in Damascus, is that Allah, this notion of the simple obtuse father, doesn't make any sense. Because the activity of the father must itself be divine. And then the presence of that divinity on earth must too be divine. If God will think, what is the nature of that thought? The nature of that thought must by its very structure be divine. And that's how the Trinity is deduced scientifically. And one of the reasons that St. John never became Islamic, although probably would have made a lot more money if he did so, was that he couldn't make sense out of a God the Father that was not productive. In the sense that his thought and action could not help but be itself divine. Infinity can only beget infinity. Now, the actual creation of matter is another world. That's another concept. We'll talk about that some other time. But in terms of his essential activity, think of it this way. God creates matter and things that are themselves not divine and yet contain the presence of the divine is something like an artist doing a painting. The painting is not human. Now, if that same artist is going to get married and have children, that child will be human. That's the difference, in simple terms, between creation out of nothing and the actual generation of divinity from his very thought. So, here's another issue. The origin of evil. All church fathers, without exception, dealt with evil, why it exists, what it is. And I tire when people who don't like the church or something like that say, how come God allows this or that to happen? Which is another way of saying, how come God doesn't arrange my life precisely the way I want it? That's essentially what they're saying. I mean, why stop at just stopping a couple of murders? Why not simply create utopia now? And yet he doesn't do that. What you might call evil, what you might call suffering in eternity may be an absolutely necessary step in the development of your mind, the development of the church, the development of whatever. St. Irenaeus, like all the church fathers, without exception, believed in free will, but they believed that free will is the result of work. Having a truly free will is hard. It is so much easier just to sink your will into the majority, to sink your will into self-interest, to sink your will into just simple materialism. It makes everything easy, at least in theory. Having a free will is very, very hard. It's something that you have to suffer for. Satan rebelled because of envy. Lucifer rebelled because he couldn't wrap his tremendous brain around spiritualization of matter. That ultimately is the nature of the incarnation. It's the nature of the sacraments in the church. It is a spiritualization of matter. The Gnostic mind is a Luciferian mind because it sees matter as this horrible evil that needs to be overcome. And therefore, only the spirit, understood in one way or another, is real. The Trinity, however, and God the Father's creation via the Son of matter was meant to unify all possible kinds of existence, to bring matter to the level of God via logos. That's something that cannot be understood by the demons. Man fell through weakness. I mean, I'm impressed that the Garden of Eden exists in almost every single culture on the globe. They call it a golden age. They call it some kind of paradise that somehow man fell from. Almost every culture on the globe has this. That's impressive. The only real justification for that fact is that it had to have existed at some point. All culture, the Greek, many cultures in the Middle East and Asia, and the ancient cultures of Latin America, they all had this doctrine that there was this golden age and something happened that people, through arrogance or through the desire for power, fell from it and destroyed it. But that implies that our history is largely one story of devolution. I don't believe in the doctrine of evolution because of its pagan background. It's a very ancient doctrine. I do, however, believe in devolution. I think devolution is clearly something that is empirically verifiable. And once the Garden of Eden was destroyed, and I'm willing to believe that, you know, eating of the apple, that could well have happened. More significantly, it's about the desire for power, the desire for domination, the desire for knowledge. It's just kind of this Promethean concept that the knowledge of technology, science and machinery, alchemy, could create man like God. And that's exactly what happened when Cain killed his brother. He went and founded a city. He was given the arts of technology, given the arts of chemistry and alchemy to create the city, to create the first empire, so to speak, which dominates others through forced labor and taxation and complete domination, complete warfare. And from then on in, until the flood, it was just one degenerate generation after another. Irenaeus does hold, and the Old Testament kind of intimates this, that prior to the flood, demons did copulate with women, and that was a creation of total corruption, and that is a creation of what we would call titans. The old Greek and Roman idea of these elemental forces, very, very powerful, they had, so to speak, the Promethean, Luciferian doctrine of geometry, of technology, sort of the resurrection the creation, I should say, of Atlantis. Ancient society that had mastered flight, that had mastered who knows what else, space travel, who knows what else, that was destroyed. These were the titans. We even call the oligarchy today, the robber barons, we call them titans, titans of industry. The idea is a control and manipulation of matter for the sake of self-interest. It is the very essence of paganism. Saint Irenaeus holds that these demons, and you know, by copulation, he wasn't just talking about sex. He's talking about teaching them. He's talking about making them into new beings. And in many, many systems of mythology, I'm thinking of the Egyptian in particular, but the Greek as well, you have gods like Apollo and Prometheus. Prometheus is another word for Lucifer. It's the same person. It's the same concept. It is set in Egypt. There's, you know, useful technology and wisdom, but then there's technology that exists for domination. The difference between someone like Horus and Set is the difference between those two uses of reason. There's reason that can help humanity, and there's reason that could provide only death and warfare. Technology, under certain limited circumstances, can be very, very good, but for the most part, at least in our age, is used for control. It is used for deceit. It is used to create images rather than truth. The origin of evil is man's desire for power. For power over others, but just as important, desire for power over nature, to recreate it to his specifications, to reject the simple life and instead seek constant dominion, imperial power, power over individuals, forced labor, and all of this requires sacrifice because it is unnatural. Because it is an intense demand made on nature that was not designed to provide that, human beings are sacrificed as a way to make up for the unnatural exploitation of the natural world. It is a ritualization of what happens in technological society. This is something that Michael Hoffman talks about in his book, Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare. This is a very introduction, but this concept goes back very, very far. And people like Irenaeus are talking about Cain, the creation of the city, and that somehow this knowledge, without previous development, seem to just explode in the creation of Babylonian, Mesopotamian civilization. Man goes from knowing nothing to building huge cities and empires. And that's remained a historical puzzle, but people like Irenaeus say that it makes perfect sense. Irenaeus believes in free will. Faith could never be real by compulsion. He does believe in a salvation from works, but that faith and works are really the same thing seen from two different points of view. Our will is directed to the earth. This is the nature of evil. And yet grace and only grace can provide it with that impetus to think and act differently. God gathers a handful of faithful people out of all nations, and they create a single church, which is the gift of immortality. Souls that are not saved die. This is a common thing in the church fathers that doesn't get much play today. The soul is not naturally immortal. The soul is fallen. It dies just like everything else dies. Justin Martyr says this, and Irenaeus says this. The soul dies. Heaven and hell are the presence of God, but heaven and hell and immortality exist only for the baptized. The others simply wink out of existence, their lives largely forgotten. But those who are gathered into the church, into the ancient Orthodox Church, which still exists on this earth, albeit in highly truncated form, that is the only way to live forever. The reprobate, those who are not baptized, are not resurrected because there's nothing to resurrect. And God deliberately leaves some in darkness. And that truly there are individuals out there who exist solely as a negative example for us. Maybe even the majority of people are superfluous. They exist as a negative example. They exist to bring torment to the church, but the church grows in power and stature as a result. He did believe in regular communion. He did believe, like all the church fathers, that the communion of the bread and wine, always leavened bread, was the true presence of Christ. And he believed that the communion should be regular, it should be often, and he also believed in public confession and public penance. And again, we're talking about the middle of the second century. Protestants for a long time, and secularists for a long time, all this stuff is much later development, and it's simply not true. And again, Irenaeus is writing this stuff, he's not saying anything new. I mean, he's writing as if to say that, yeah, this stuff has been around for a long time, we need to keep with this tradition, and others have fallen away from this tradition. But he also says that there will come a time where the church will be driven into the wilderness. There'll be a handful of people left, and the Antichrist will come. And the Antichrist is the builders and the creators of the new Jerusalem temple. Now, the Temple of Solomon is a Gnostic symbol. It may not necessarily literally be the actual temple sitting in Jerusalem. Irenaeus hints that Antichrist will be Judaic. That could either be an individual Jew or the Jews collectively. And Antichrist will sit at the remade Temple of Solomon. That does not necessarily refer to the building. The Temple of Solomon, for all of you who know, is the icon of the New World Order. It is the Gnosis in symbolic, iconic form of what the new order will be, a single global machine dominated by a handful of oligarchs heavily initiated into the dark arts. And the fact that the Rothschild family had its own Masonic lodge in London, far as I know, still has its own Masonic lodge in London, and that the Temple of Solomon is the single most important symbol in all Masonic initiation rituals. It's everywhere. A lot of these people, a lot of these Protestants who don't know anything, they'll talk about, oh, they're going to rebuild the temple, and either this will be the end, or it will be perverse, and it'll be a good thing, it'll be a bad thing. No, the more significant concept is that the Temple of Solomon is a symbol of global state control, the global international capitalist machine or it won't even be, I mean, capitalism, communism, they're very similar. It is a materialist machine that will completely dominate nature and human beings. It is prophesied in the book of Daniel with the three children in the furnace. The point is that this global machine, the ultimate presence of Satan on earth, will have a brief period of dominion and a handful of those following the ancient path will be left, and that those will be driven into the wilderness. When Christ will finally destroy all of this, he will return earth to its pristine state. All matter and all spirit will interfuse with one another, interpenetrate with one another to create the new heavens and the new earth that Christ himself speaks of. Well, I run out of time. This is a very, very thumbnail abstract of St. Irenaeus and really the early pre-Nicene tradition of the ancient church, the Orthodox Church, largely speaking Greek, whether Western or Eastern. And this is the vision of St. Irenaeus, very common at the time. This is the Greek Orthodox vision prior to Nicaea, and it is the apostolic expression, because St. Irenaeus himself was a student of Polycarp. And this is the expression of the Apostle John. To ignore these people is, you do so at your own peril. Whether you're a scholar and you're trying to understand Christianity, you can't understand it without listening to these guys. If you're a Christian and trying to get to the truth of the matter, you can't understand any of it without these guys. If you're a seeker and you don't know what the truth is, you have one option, and that is to read these guys and to recognize that these men are speaking from the apostolic point of view because they had received it from the apostles. Okay, thank you for listening, folks. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.